from the governor that we're not going to do any proactive detention. No one gets arrested until they do something. Angry voices rose in chorus. Who does he think he is? Someone called from the back. Shadid snapped at the comment like a shark. The governor is the one who contracted with us to keep this station in working order, Shadid said. We'll follow his directives. In his peripheral vision, Miller saw Havelock nod. He wondered what the governor thought of the question of Belter independence. Maybe the OPA weren't the only ones who'd been waiting for something like this to happen. Shadid went on, outlining the security response they were permitted. Miller listened with half an ear, so lost in speculating on the politics behind the situation he almost missed it when Shadid called his name. Miller will take the second team to the port level and cover sectors 13 through 24, Kasagawa team 3, 25 through 36, and so on. That's 20 men apiece, except for Miller. I can make it with 19, Miller said, then quietly to Havelock. You're sitting this one out, partner. Having an Earther with a gun out there isn't going to make things better.
Yeah, Havelock said. Saw that coming.
Okay, Shadid said. You all know the drill? Let's move. Miller rounded up his riot squad. All the faces were familiar. All men and women he'd worked with over his years in security. He organized them in his mind with a nearly automatic efficiency. Brown and Gelbfish both had SWAT experience, so they would lead the wings if it came to crowd control. Aberforth had 3 write-ups for excessive violence since her kid had been busted for drug running on Ganymede, so she was second string. She could work out her anger management issues another time. Around the station house, he heard the other squad commanders making similar decisions.
Okay, Miller said. Let's suit up.
They moved away in a group, heading for the equipment bay. Miller paused. Havelock remained leaning against his desk, arms folded, eyes locked on the middle distance. Miller was torn between sympathy for the man and impatience. It was hard being on the team, but not on the team. On the other hand, what the hell had he expected, taking a contract in the belt? Havelock looked up, meeting Miller's gaze. They nodded to each other. Miller was the first to turn away. The equipment bay was part warehouse, part bank vault, designed by someone more concerned with conserving space than getting things out efficiently. The lights, recessed white LEDs, gave the gray walls a sterile cast. Bare stone echoed every voice and footfall. Banks of ammunition and firearms, evidence bags and test panels, spare servers and replacement uniforms lined the walls and filled most of the interior space. The riot gear was in a side room, in gray steel lockers with high-security electronic locks. The standard outfit consisted of high-impact plastic shields, electric batons, shin guards, bullet-resistant chest and thigh armor, and helmets with reinforced face guards. All of it designed to make a handful of station security into an intimidating, inhuman force. Miller keyed in his access code. The seals released. The lockers opened.
Well, Miller said conversationally, fuck me.
The lockers were empty. Gray coffins with the corpses all gone. Across the room, he heard one of the other squads shouting in outrage. Miller systematically opened every riot control locker he could get to. All of them were the same. Shadid appeared at his side, her face pale with rage.
What's Plan B? Miller asked.
Shadid spat on the floor, then closed her eyes. They shifted under her lids like she was dreaming. 2 long breaths later, they opened.
Check the SWAT lockers. There should be enough in there to outfit 2 people in each squad.
Snipers? Miller said.
You have a better idea, detective?
Shadid said, leaning on the last word. Miller raised his hands in surrender. Riot gear was meant to intimidate and control. SWAT gear was made to kill with the greatest efficiency possible. Seemed their mandate had just changed.
On any given day, 1,000 ships might be docked on Ceres Station, and activity there rarely slowed and never stopped. Each sector could accommodate 20 ships, the traffic of humanity and cargo, transport vans, mesocranes, and industrial forklifts, and his squad was responsible for 20 sectors. The air stank of refrigerant and oil. The gravity was slightly above 0.3G, station spin alone lending the place a sense of oppression and danger. Miller didn't like the port. Having vacuum so close under his feet made him nervous. Passing the dock workers and transport crews, he didn't know whether to scowl or smile. He was here to scare people into behaving, and also to reassure them that everything was under control. After the first 3 sectors, he settled on the smile. It was the kind of lie he was better at. They had just reached the junction of sectors 19 and 20 when they heard screaming. Miller pulled his hand terminal out of his pocket, connected to the central surveillance network, and called up the security camera array. It took a few seconds to find it. A mob of 50 or 60 civilians stretching almost all the way across the tunnel, traffic blocked on both sides. There were weapons being waved over heads, knives, clubs, at least 2 pistols, fists pumped in the air. And at the center of the crowd, a huge shirtless man was beating someone to death. "Showtime," Miller said, waving his squad forward at a run. He was still 100 meters from the turn that would take them to the clot of human violence when he saw the shirtless man knock his victim to the ground, then stomp on her neck. The head twisted sideways at an angle that didn't leave any question. Miller slowed his team to a brisk walk. Arresting the murderer while surrounded by a crowd of his friends would be tough enough without being winded. There was blood in the water now. Miller could sense it. The mob was going to turn out. To the station. To the ships. If the people started joining the chaos, what path would it be likely to take? There was a brothel 1 level up from there and 0.5 kilometer anti-spinward that catered to inner planet types. The tariff inspector for Sector 21 was married to a girl from Luna, and had bragged about it maybe once too often. There were too many targets, Miller thought, even as he motioned his snipers to spread out. He was trying to reason with a fire. Stop it here, and no one else got killed. In his imagination, Candace crossed her arms and said, "What's Plan B?" The outer edge of the mob raised the alarm well before Miller reached it. The surge of bodies and threat shifted. Miller tipped back his hat. Men, women, dark skin, pale, golden brown, and all with the long, thin build of belters, all with the square-mouthed, angry gape of chimpanzees at war. "Let me take a couple of them down, sir," Gelbfish said from his terminal. "Put the fear of God into them." "We'll get there," Miller said, smiling at the angry mob. "We'll get there." The face he expected floated to the front, shirtless, the big man, blood covering his hands and splattered on his cheek, the seed crystal of the riot. "That one?" Gelbfish asked, and Miller knew that a tiny infrared dot was painting shirtless's forehead, even as he glowered at Miller and the uniforms behind him. "No," Miller said. "That'll only set the rest of them off." "So what do we do?" Brown said. It was a hell of a question. "Sir," Gelbfish said, "the big fucker's got an OPA tattoo on his left shoulder." "Well," Miller said, "if you do have to shoot him, start there." He stepped forward, tying his terminal into the local system, overriding the alert. When he spoke, his voice boomed from the overhead speakers. "This is Detective Miller. Unless you all want to be locked up as accessories to murder, I suggest you disperse now." Muting the microphone in his terminal, he said to Shirtless, "Not you, big fella. Move a muscle and we shoot you." Someone in the crowd threw a wrench, the silver metal arcing low through the air toward Miller's head. He almost stepped out of the way, but the handle caught him across the ear. His head was filled with the deep sound of bells, and the wet of blood tracked down his neck.
"Hold fire!" Miller shouted. "Hold your fire!"
The crowd laughed, as if he'd been talking to them. Idiots. Shirtless, emboldened, strode forward. The steroids had distended his thigh so badly that he waddled. Miller turned the mic on his terminal back on. If the crowd was watching them face each other down, they weren't breaking things. It wasn't spreading. Not yet.
"So, friend, you only kick helpless people to death, or can anybody join in?"
Miller asked, his voice conversational but echoing out of the dock speakers like a pronouncement from God.
"The fuck you barking, Earth dog?" Shirtless said.
"Earth?" Miller said, chuckling. "I look like I grew up in a gravity well to you? I was born on this rock."
"Innes kibble, you bitch," Shirtless said. "You the dog."
"You think?"
"Fucking dway," Shirtless said. "Fucking true."
He flexed his pectorals. Miller suppressed the urge to laugh.
"So, killing that poor bastard was for the good of the station?" Miller said. "The good of the belt?"
"Don't be a chump, kid. They're playing you. They want you to act like a bunch of stupid riot boys, so they have a reason to shut this place down."
"Schrauben Sie die Weibchen,"
Shirtless said in Belter-inflected gutter German, leaning forward. "Okay, second time I've been called a bitch," Miller thought.
"Kneecap him," Miller said.
Shirtless's legs blew out in twin sprays of crimson, and he went down howling. Miller walked past his writhing body, stepping toward the mob.
"You're taking your orders from this pendejo?" he said. "Listen to me. We all know what's coming. We know dance starting now, like pow, right? They fuck tu agua, and we all know the answer. Out in airlock, no?"
He could see it in their faces, the sudden fear of the snipers, then the confusion. He pressed on, not giving them time to think. He switched back to the lower-level lingo, the language of education. Authority.
"You know what Mars wants? They want you doing this. They want this piece of shit here to make sure that everyone looks at Belters and thinks we're a bunch of psychopaths who tear up their own station. They want to tell themselves we're just like them. Well, we aren't. We're Belters, and we take care of our own."
He picked a man at the edge of the mob. Not as pumped as Shirtless, but big. He had an OPA split circle on his arm.
"You," Miller said. "You want to fight for the belt?"
"Dway,"
the man said.
"I bet you do.
He did too,"
Miller said, jerking a thumb back at Shirtless. "But now he's a cripple, and he's going down for murder. So we've already lost one, you see? They're turning us against each other. Can't let them do that. Every one of you I have to arrest or cripple or kill, that's one less we have when the day comes. And it's coming. But it's not now, you understand?" The OPA man scowled. The mob drew back from him, making space. Miller could feel it like a current against him. It was shifting.
"Day's coming, hombre," the OPA man said. "You know your side?"
The tone was a threat, but there was no power behind it. Miller took a slow breath. It was over.
"Always the side of the angels," he said. "Why don't you all go back to work? Show's over here, and we've all got plenty that needs doing."
Momentum broken, the mob fell apart. First one and two peeling off from the edges, and then the whole knot untying itself at once. 5 minutes after Miller had arrived, the only signs that anything had happened were Shirtless mewling in a pool of his own blood, the wound on Miller's ear, and the body of the woman 50 good citizens had stood by and watched be beaten to death. She was short, and wearing the flight suit of a Martian freight line.
"Only one dead. Makes it a good night," Miller thought sourly.
He went to the fallen man. The OPA tattoo was smeared red. Miller knelt.
"Friend," he said, "you are under arrest for the murder of that lady over there, whoever the hell she is.
You are not required to participate in questioning without the presence of an attorney or union representative, and if you so much as look at me wrong, I'll space you. Do we understand each other? From the look in the man's eyes, Miller knew they did. Chapter 7. Holden. Holden could drink coffee at half a G, actually sit and hold a mug under his nose and let the aroma drift up, sip it slowly and not burn his tongue. Drinking coffee was one of the activities that didn't make the transition to microgravity well, but at half a G, it was fine. So he sat and tried very hard to think about coffee and gravity and the silence of the night's tiny galley. Even the normally talkative Alex was quiet. Amos had set his big handgun on the table and was staring at it with frightening concentration. Shed was asleep. Naomi was sitting across the room, drinking tea and keeping one eye on the wall panel next to her. She'd routed ops to it. As long as he kept his mind on his coffee, he didn't have to think about Ade giving one last gasp of fear and then turning into a glowing vapor. Alex ruined it by speaking.
At some point, we need to decide where we're going, he said.
Holden nodded, took a sip of his coffee, and closed his eyes. His muscles vibrated like plucked strings, and his peripheral vision was dappled with points of imaginary light. The first twinges of the post-juice crash were starting, and it was going to be a bad one. He wanted to enjoy these last few moments before the pain hit.
He's right, Jim, Naomi said. We can't just fly in a big circle at half a G forever.
Holden didn't open his eyes. The darkness behind his lids was bright and active and mildly nauseating.
We aren't waiting forever, he said.
We're waiting 50 minutes for Saturn Station to call me back and tell me what to do with their ship. The night is still P&K property. We're still employees. You wanted me to call for help, I called for help. Now we are waiting to see what that looks like.
Shouldn't we start flying toward Saturn Station then, boss?
Amos asked, directing his question at Naomi. Alex snorted.
Not on the Knight's engine. Even if we had the fuel for that trip, which we don't, I don't want to sit in this can for the next 3 months, he said. No, if we're going somewhere, it's got to be the Belt or Jupiter, or as close to exactly between them as you can get.
I vote we continue on to Ceres, Naomi said. P&K has offices there. We don't know anyone in the Jupiter complex.
Without opening his eyes, Holden shook his head. No. We wait for them to call us back. Naomi made an exasperated sound. It was funny, he thought, how you could make someone's voice out from the smallest sounds, a cough or a sigh, or the little gasp right before she died. Holden sat up and opened his eyes. He placed his coffee mug on the table carefully, with hands that were starting to palsy.
I don't want to fly sunward to Ceres because that's the direction the torpedo ship went. And your point about chasing them is well taken, Naomi. I don't want to fly out to Jupiter because we only have the fuel for one trip, and once we fly that direction for a while, we're locked in. We are sitting here and drinking coffee because I need to make a decision, and P&K gets a say in that decision. So we wait for them to answer, and then I decide.
Holden got up slowly, carefully, and began moving toward the crew ladder.
I'm going to crash for a few minutes, let the worst of the shakes wear off. If P&K calls, let me know.
Holden popped sedative tabs, thin, bitter pills with an aftertaste like bread mold, but he didn't sleep. Over and over, McDowell placed a hand on his arm and called him Jim. Becca laughed and cursed like a sailor. Cameron bragged about his prowess on the ice. Ade gasped. Holden had flown the Ceres to Saturn circuit on the Canterbury 9 times, 2 round trips a year for almost 5 years. Most of the crew had been there the entire time. Flying on the Cant might be the bottom of the barrel, but that meant there was nowhere else to go. People stayed, made the ship their home. After the near-constant duty transfers of the Navy, he appreciated stability. Made it his home, too. McDowell said something he couldn't quite make out. The cant groaned like she was under a hard burn. Ade smiled and winked at him. The worst leg cramp in history hit every muscle in his body at once. Holden bit down hard on his rubber mouthguard, screaming. The pain brought an oblivion that was almost a relief. His mind shut off, drowned out by the needs of his body. Fortunately or not, the drugs started to kick in. His muscles unknotted. His nerves stopped screaming, and consciousness returned like a reluctant schoolboy. His jaw ached as he pulled out the guard. He'd worn tooth marks in the rubber. In the dim blue cabin light, he thought about the kind of man who followed an order to kill a civilian ship. He'd done some things in the Navy that had kept him awake nights. He'd followed some orders he vehemently disagreed with. But to lock on to a civilian ship with 50 people aboard and press the button that launched 6 nuclear weapons? He would have refused. If his commanding officer had insisted, he'd have declared it an illegal order and demanded that the executive officer take control of the ship and arrest the captain. They'd have had to shoot him to get him away from the weapon post. He'd known the sort of people who would have followed the order, though. He told himself that they were sociopaths and animals, no better than pirates who'd board your ship, strip your engine, and take your air, that they weren't human. But even as he nursed his hatred, drug-hazed rage offering its nihilistic comforts, he couldn't believe they were idiots. The itch at the back of his head was still, why? What does anyone gain from killing an ice hauler? Who gets paid? Someone always gets paid. I'm going to find you. I'm going to find you and end you. But before I do, I'm going to make you explain. The second wave of pharmaceuticals exploded in his bloodstream. He was hot and limp, his veins filled with syrup. Just before the tabs finally knocked him out, Ade smiled and winked and blew away like dust. The comm beeped at him. Naomi's voice said, "Jim, the PNK response finally came in. Want me to send it down there?" Holden struggled to make sense of the words, blinked. Something was wrong with his bunk, with the ship. Slowly, he remembered. "Jim?" "No," he said. "I want to watch it up in ops with you. How long was I out?"
3 hours, she said.
"Jesus, they took their sweet time getting back to us, didn't they?" Holden rolled out of his couch and wiped off the crust that held his eyelashes together. He'd been weeping in his sleep. He told himself it was from the juice crash. The deep ache in his chest was only stressed cartilage. "What were you doing for 3 hours before you called us back?" he wondered. Naomi waited for him at the comm station, a man's face frozen mid-word on the screen in front of her. He seemed familiar.
"That isn't the operations manager."
"Nope, it's the PNK legal counsel on Saturn Station. The one who gave that speech after the crackdown on supply pilfering," Naomi said. "Stealing from us is stealing from you. That one."
"Lawyer," Holden said with a grimace. "This is going to be bad news then."
Naomi restarted the message. The lawyer sprang into motion. "James Holden, this is Wallace Fitz calling from Saturn Station. We've received your request for help and your report of the incident. We've also received your broadcast accusing Mars of destroying the Canterbury. This was, to say the least, ill-advised. The Martian representative on Saturn Station was in my office not 5 minutes after your broadcast was received, and the MCR is quite upset by what they view as unfounded accusations of piracy by their government. To further investigate this matter and to aid in discovering the true wrongdoers, if any, the MCRN is dispatching one of their ships from the Jupiter system to pick you up. The MCRN Doniger is the name of this vessel.
Your orders from P&K are as follows. You will fly at best possible speed to the Jupiter system. You will cooperate fully with instructions given you by the MCRN Doniger, or by any officer of the Martian Congressional Republic Navy. You will assist the MCRN in their investigation into the destruction of the Canterbury. You will refrain from any further broadcasting except to us or the Doniger. If you fail to follow these instructions from the company and from the government of Mars, your contract with P&K will be terminated, and you will be considered in illegal possession of a P&K shuttlecraft. We will then prosecute you to the fullest extent of the law. Wallace Fitz, out.
Holden frowned at the monitor, then shook his head. I never said Mars did it.
You sort of did, Naomi replied. I didn't say anything that wasn't entirely factual and backed up by the data I transmitted, and I engaged in no speculation about those facts.
So, Naomi said, what do we do?
No fucking way, Amos said. No fucking way.
The galley was a small space. The five of them filled it uncomfortably. The gray laminate walls showed whorls of bright scrapes where mold had grown once and been cleaned off with microwaves and steel wool. Shed sat with his back against the wall, Naomi across the table. Alex stood in the doorway. Amos started pacing along the back. Two fast paces, then a turn, before the lawyer had finished his first sentence.
I'm not happy about it either, but that's the word from the Home Office, Holden said, pointing at the galley's display screen. Didn't mean to get you guys in trouble.
No problem, Holden. I still think you did the right thing, Shed replied, running one hand through his limp blonde hair.
So what do you think the Martians will do with us?
I'm thinking pull our fucking toes off until Holden goes back on the radio and says it wasn't them, Amos said.
What in the holy hell is this? They attacked us and now we're supposed to cooperate? They killed the captain.
Amos, Holden said.
Sorry, Holden, Captain, Amos said. But Jesus wept. We're getting fucked here and not the nice way. We're not gonna do this, are we?
I don't want to disappear into some Martian prison ship forever, Holden said. The way I see it, we have two options. Either we go along with this, which is basically throwing ourselves on their mercy, or we run, try to make it to the belt and hide.
I'm voting for the belt, Naomi said, her arms crossed.
Amos raised a hand, seconding the motion. Shed slowly raised his own. Alex shook his head.
I know the Doniger, he said. She's not some rockhopper. She's the flagship for the MCRN's Jupiter fleet. Battleship. 250,000 tons of bad news.
You ever serve on a ship that size?
No, I wasn't on anything bigger than a destroyer, Holden replied. I served on the Bandon with the home fleet. We can't go anywhere that a ship like that can't find us. She's got four main engines, each one bigger than our whole ship. She's designed for long periods at high G with every sailor on board juiced to the gills. We can't run, sir. And even if we did, her sensor package could track a golf ball and hit it with a torpedo from half the solar system away.
Oh, fuck that, sir, Amos said, standing up. These Martian needle dicks blew up the Cant. I say run. At least make it hard for them.
Naomi put one hand on Amos's forearm. And the big mechanic paused, shook his head, and sat down. The galley was silent. Holden wondered if McDowell had ever had to make a call like this, and what the old man would have done.
Jim, this is your decision, she said, but her eyes were hard.
No. What you are going to do is get the remaining four members of your crew to safety, and that's all, she thought.
Holden nodded. And tapped his fingers against his lips.
P&K doesn't have our back on this one. We probably can't get away, but I don't want to disappear either, Holden said. And then, I think we go, but we don't go quietly. Why don't we go disobey the spirit of an order?
Naomi finished working on the comm panel.
her hair now floating around her like a black cloud in the zero-G.
"Okay, Jim, I'm dumping every watt into the comm array. They'll be getting this loud and clear all the way out to Titania," she said. Holden reached up to run one hand through his sweat-plastered hair. In the null gravity, that just made it stick straight out in every direction. He zipped up his flight suit and pressed the record button. "This is James Holden, formerly of the Canterbury, now on the shuttle Knight. We are cooperating with an investigation into who destroyed the Canterbury, and as part of that cooperation are agreeing to be taken aboard your ship, the MCRN Doniger. We hope that this cooperation means that we will not be held prisoner or harmed. Any such action would only serve to reinforce the idea that the Canterbury was destroyed by a Martian vessel." James Holden out. Holden leaned back. "Naomi, send that out broadband."
"That's a dirty trick, boss," said Alex. "Pretty hard to disappear us now."
"I believe in the ideal of the transparent society, Mr. Kamal," said Holden. Alex grinned, pushed off, and floated down the gangway. Naomi tapped the comm panel, making a small, satisfied sound in the back of her throat. "Naomi?" Holden said. She turned, her hair waving lazily like they were both drowning. "If this goes badly, I need you to..."
"Throw you to the wolves?" she said.
"Blame everything on you and get the others back to Saturn Station safely?"
"Yeah," Holden said. "Don't play the hero."
She let the words hang in the air until the last of the irony leached out of them.
"Hadn't crossed my mind, sir," she said.
"Knight, this is Captain Teresa Yao of the MCRN Doniger," said the severe-looking woman on the comm screen. "Message received. Please refrain from further general broadcasts. My navigator will be sending course information shortly. Follow that course exactly. Yao out."
Alex laughed.
"I think you pissed her off," he said.
"Got the course info. They'll be picking us up in 13 days. Give her time to really stew on it."
13 days before I'm clapped in irons and have needles shoved under my fingernails," Holden sighed, leaning back in his couch.
"Well, best begin our flight toward imprisonment and torture. You may lock in the transmitted course, Mr. Kamal."
"Roger that, Cap."
"Huh," said Alex. "A problem?"
"Well, the Knight just did her pre-burn sweep for collision objects," Alex said. "And we have 6 belt objects on an intercept course."
"Belt objects?"
"Fast contacts with no transponder signal," Alex replied. "Ships, but flying dark. They'll catch us just about 2 days before the Doniger does."
Holden pulled up the display. 6 small signatures, yellow-orange shifting toward red. Heavy burn.
"Well," Holden said to the screen, "and who the hell are you?"
Chapter 8. Miller.
Aggression against the belt is what Earth and Mars survive on. Our weakness is their strength, the masked woman said from Miller's terminal screen. The split circle of the OPA draped behind her like something painted on a sheet. Don't be afraid of them. Their only power is your fear.
Well, that and 100 or so gunships, Havelock said. From what I hear, Miller said, if you clap your hands and say you believe, they can't shoot you. I have to try that sometime.
We must rise up, the woman said, her voice growing shrill. We have to take our destiny before it is taken from us. Remember the Canterbury.
Miller shut the viewer down and leaned back in his chair. The station was at its change of shift surge. Voices raised one over the other as the previous round of cops brought the incoming ones up to speed. The smell of fresh coffee competed with cigarette smoke.
There's maybe 12 like her, Havelock said, nodding toward the dead terminal screen. She's my favorite, though. There are times I swear she's actually foaming at the mouth.
How many more files? Miller asked, and his partner shrugged. 200, 300, Havelock said, and took a drag on his cigarette. He'd started smoking again. Every few hours there's a new one. They aren't coming from one place. Sometimes they're broadcast on the radio, sometimes the files show up on public partitions. Orlan found some guys at a portside bar passing out these little VR squids like they were pamphlets. She bust them? No, Havelock said, as if it was no big deal. A week had passed since James Holden, self-appointed martyr, had proudly announced that he and his crew were going to talk to someone from the Martian Navy instead of just slinging shit and implications. The footage of the Canterbury's death was everywhere, debates raging over every frame. The log files that documented the incident were perfectly legitimate, or they were obviously doctored. The torpedoes that had slaughtered the hauler were nukes, or standard pirate fare that breached the drive by mistake, or it was all artifice lifted from old stock footage to cover up what had really killed the Cant. The riots had lasted for 3 days, on and off, like a fire hot enough to reignite every time the air pumped back in. The administrative offices reopened under heavy security, but they reopened. The ports fell behind, but they were catching up. The shirtless bastard who Miller had ordered shot was in the Star Helix detainment infirmary, getting new knees, filling out protests against Miller and preparing for his murder trial. 600 cubic meters of nitrogen had gone missing from a warehouse in Sector 15. An unlicensed whore had been beaten up and locked in a storage unit. As soon as she was done giving evidence about her attackers, she'd be arrested. They'd caught the kids who'd been breaking the surveillance cameras on Level 16. Superficially, everything was business as usual. Only superficially. When Miller had started working homicide, one of the things that had struck him was the surreal calm of the victims' families. People who had just lost wives, husbands, children, and lovers. People whose lives had just been branded by violence. More often than not, they were calmly offering drinks and answering questions, making the detectives feel welcome. A civilian coming in unaware might have mistaken them for whole. It was only in the careful way they held themselves, and the extra quarter second it took their eyes to focus, that Miller could see how deep the damage was. Ceres Station was holding itself carefully. Its eyes were taking a quarter second longer to focus. Middle-class people, storekeepers, maintenance workers, computer techs, were avoiding him on the tube the way petty criminals did. Conversations died when Miller came near. In the station, the sense of being under siege was growing. A month earlier, Miller and Havelock, Cobb and Richter and the rest had been the steadying hand of the law. Now, they were employees of an Earth-based security contractor. The difference was subtle, but it was deep. It made him want to stand taller, to show with his body that he was a belter, that he belonged there. It made him want to win people's good opinion back. Let by a bunch of guys passing out virtual reality propaganda with a warning, maybe. It wasn't a smart impulse. What have we got on the board? Miller asked. 2 burglaries that looked like that same ring, Havelock said. That domestic dispute from last week still needs the report closed up. There was a pretty good assault over by Nakanesh Import Consortium, but Shadid was talking to Dyson and Patel about that, so it's probably spoken for already. So you want... Havelock looked up and out to cover the fact that he was looking away. It was something he'd been doing more often since things had gone to shit. We've really got to get the reports done, Havelock said. Not just the domestic. There are 4 or 5 folders that are only still open because they need to be crossed and dotted. Yeah, Miller said. Since the riots, he'd watched everyone in a bar get served before Havelock. He'd seen how the other cops from Shadid down went out of their way to reassure Miller that he was one of the good guys, a tacit apology for saddling him with an earther. And he'd seen Havelock see it, too. It made Miller want to protect the man,
to let Havelock spend his days in the safety of paperwork and station house coffee. Helped the man pretend that he wasn't hated for the gravity he'd grown up in. That wasn't a smart impulse either.
"What about your bullshit case?" Havelock asked.
"What?" Havelock held up a folder. "The Julie Mao case. The kidnap job. The sideshow." Miller nodded and rubbed his eyes. Someone at the front of the station house yelped. Someone else laughed.
"Yeah, no," Miller said. "Haven't touched it."
Havelock grinned and held it out to him. Miller accepted the file, flipped it open. The 18-year-old grinned out at him with perfect teeth.
"I don't want to saddle you with all the desk driving," Miller said. "Hey, you're not the one that kept me off that one. That was Shadid's call. And anyway, it's just paperwork. Never killed anyone. You feel guilty about it? You can buy me a beer after work."
Miller tapped the case against the corner of his desk, the small impact settling the contents against the folder's spine.
"Right," he said. "I'll go do some follow-up on the bullshit. I'll be back by lunch. Write something up to keep the boss happy."
"I'll be here," Havelock said. Then, as Miller rose,
"Hey, look, I didn't want to say anything until I was sure, but I also don't want you to hear it someplace else."
"Put in for a transfer?" Miller said.
"Yeah.
Talk to some of those Protogen contractors that passed through. They say their Ganymede office is looking for a new lead investigator, and I thought..." Havelock shrugged.
"It's a good move," Miller said.
"Just want to go someplace with a sky, even if you look at it through domes," Havelock said, and all the bluff masculinity of police work couldn't keep the wistfulness out of his voice.
"It's a good move," Miller said again.
Juliet Andromeda Mao's hole was in the 9th level of a 14-tiered tunnel near the port. The great inverted V was almost half a kilometer wide at the top and no more than a standard tube width at the bottom, the retrofit of one of a dozen reaction mass chambers from the years before the asteroid had been given its false gravity. Now, thousands of cheap holes burrowed into the walls, hundreds on each level, heading straight back like shotgun shacks. Kids played on the terraced streets, shrieking and laughing at nothing. Someone at the bottom was flying a kite in the constant gentle spin breeze, the bright mylar diamond swerving and bucking in the micro-turbulence. Miller checked his terminal against the numbers painted on the wall. 5151-I. Home sweet home to the poor little rich girl. He keyed his override, and the dirty green door popped its seals and let him pass. The hole canted up into the body of the station. 3 small rooms. General living space at the front, then a bedroom hardly larger than the cot it contained, then a stall with shower, toilet, and half-sink, all within elbow distance. It was a standard design. He'd seen it 1,000 times. Miller stood for a minute, not looking at anything in particular, listening to the reassuring hiss of air cycling through the ductwork. He reserved judgment, waiting as the back of his head built an impression of the place and, through it, of the girl who'd lived there. Spartan was the wrong word. The place was simple, yes. The only decorations were a small framed watercolor of a slightly abstracted woman's face over the table in the front room, and a cluster of playing card-sized plaques over the cot in the bedroom. He leaned close to read the small script. A formal award granting Julie Mao, not Juliet, purple belt status by the Ceres Center for Jiu-Jitsu. Another stepping her up to brown belt. They were 2 years apart. Tough school, then. He put his fingers on the empty space on the wall where one for black could go. There was none of the affectation. No stylized throwing stars or imitation swords. Just a small acknowledgement that Julie Mao had done what she had done. He gave her points for that. The drawers had 2 changes of clothes, one of heavy canvas and denim and one of blue linen with a silk scarf. One for work, one for play. It was less than Miller owned, and he was hardly a clothes horse.
With her socks and underwear was a wide armband with a split circle of the OPA. Not a surprise for a girl who turned her back on wealth and privilege to live in a dump like this. The refrigerator had two takeaway boxes filled with spoiled food and a bottle of local beer. Miller hesitated, then took the beer. He sat at the table and pulled up the hole's built-in terminal. True to Shadid's word, Julie's partition opened to Miller's password. The custom background was a racing pinnace. The interface was customized in small, legible iconography. Communication, entertainment, work, personal. Elegant. That was the word. Not Spartan, but elegant. He paged quickly through her professional files, letting his mind take in an overview, just as he had with the whole living space. There would be time for rigor, and a first impression was usually more useful than an encyclopedia. She had training videos on several different light transport craft. Some political archives, but nothing that raised a flag. A scanned volume of poetry by some of the first settlers in the belt. He shifted to her personal correspondence. It was all kept as neat and controlled as a belter's. All incoming messages were filtered to subfolders. Work, personal, broadcast, shopping. He popped open broadcast. 200 or 300 political news feeds, discussion group digests, bulletins and announcements. A few had been viewed here and there, but nothing with any sort of religious observation. Julie was the kind of woman who would sacrifice for a cause, but not the kind who'd take joy in reading the propaganda. Miller filed that away. Shopping was a long tracking of simple merchant messages. Some receipts, some announcements, some requests for goods and services. A cancellation for a belt-based singles circle caught his eye. Miller resorted for related correspondence. Julie had signed up for the low-G, low-pressure dating service in February of the previous year and canceled in June without having used it. The personal folder was more diverse. At a rough guess, there were 60 or 70 subfolders broken down by name. Some were people. Sasha Lloyd Navarro, Aaron Michaels. Others were private notations. Sparring circle, OPA. Bullshit guilt trips. Well, this could be interesting, he said to the empty hole. 50 messages dating back 5 years. All marked as originating at the Mao Kwiatkowski mercantile stations, in the Belt and on Luna. Unlike the political tracts, all but one had been opened. Miller took a pull from the beer and considered the most recent two messages. The most recent, still unread, was from J.P.M., Jules-Pierre Mao, at a guess. The one immediately before it showed three drafted replies, none of them sent. It was from Ariadne, the mother. There was always an element of voyeurism in being a detective. It was legal for him to be here, poking through the private life of a woman he'd never met. It was part of his legitimate investigation to know that she was lonely, that the only toiletries in her bathroom were her own, that she was proud. No one would have any complaints to make, or at least any that carried repercussions for his job, if he read every private message on her partition. Drinking her beer was the most ethically suspect thing he'd done since he'd come in. And still, he hesitated for a few seconds before opening the second-to-last message. The screen shifted. On better equipment, it would have been indistinguishable from ink on paper, but Julie's cheap system shuddered at the thinnest lines and leaked a soft glow at the left edge. The handwriting was delicate and legible, either done with a calligraphic software good enough to vary letter shape and line width, or else handwritten. Sweetheart, I hope everything's going well for you. I wish you would write to me on your own sometimes. I feel like I have to put in a request in triplicate just to hear how my own daughter is doing. I know this adventure of yours is all about freedom and self-reliance, but surely there's still room in there to be considerate. I wanted to get in touch with you especially because your father is going through one of his consolidation phases again,
and were thinking of selling the Razorback. I know it was important to you once, but I suppose we've all given up on your racing again. It's just racking up storage fees now, and there's no call to be sentimental. It was signed with the flowing initials, A.M. Miller considered the words. Somehow he'd expected the paternal exhortations of the very rich to be more subtle. If you don't do as we say, we'll get rid of your toys. If you don't write, if you don't come home, if you don't love us. Miller opened the first incomplete draft. Mother, if that's what you call yourself, thank you so much for dropping yet another turd onto my day. I can't believe how selfish and petty and crude you are. I can't believe you sleep at night, or that you ever thought I could... Miller skimmed the rest. The tone seemed consistent. The second draft reply was dated 2 days later. He skipped to it. Mom, I'm sorry we've been so estranged these last few years. I know it's been hard for you and for Daddy. I hope you can see that the decisions I've made were never meant to hurt either of you. About the Razorback, I wish you'd reconsider. She's my first boat, and I... It stopped there. Miller leaned back.
Steady on, kid, he said to the imaginary Julie, then opened the last draft.
Ariadne, do what you have to do. Julie. Miller laughed and raised his bottle to the screen in toast. They'd known how to hit her where it hurt, and Julie had taken the blow. If he ever caught her and shipped her back, it was going to be a bad day for both of them. All of them. He finished the beer, dropped the bottle into the recycling chute, and opened the last message. He more than half dreaded learning the final fate of the Razorback, but it was his job to know as much as he could. Julie, this is not a joke. This is not one of your mother's drama fits. I have solid information that the Belt is about to be a very unsafe place. Whatever differences we have, we can work out later. For your own safety, come home now. Miller frowned. The air recycler hummed. Outside, the local kids whistled high and loud. He tapped the screen, closing the last bullshit guilt trip message, then opened it again. It had been sent from Luna, 2 weeks before James Holden and the Canterbury raised the specter of war between Mars and the Belt. This sideshow was getting interesting. Chapter 9. Holden. The ships are still not responding, Naomi said, punching a key sequence on the comm panel. I didn't think they would, but I want to show the Dunnager that we're worried about being followed. It's all covering our asses at this point, Holden said. Naomi's spine popped as she stretched. Holden pulled a protein bar out of the box in his lap and threw it at her. Eat. She peeled the wrapping off while Amos clambered up the ladder and threw himself into the couch next to her. His coverall was so filthy it shined. Just as with the others, 3 days on the cramped shuttle hadn't helped his personal hygiene. Holden reached up and scratched his own greasy hair with distaste. The night was too small for showers, and the zero-g sinks were too small to stick your head in. Amos had solved the hair-washing problem by shaving all of his off. Now he just had a ring of stubble around his bald spot. Somehow, Naomi's hair stayed shiny and mostly oil-free. Holden wondered how she did that. Toss me some chow, XO, Amos said. Captain, Naomi corrected. Holden threw a protein bar at him, too. Amos snatched it from the air, then considered the long, thin package with distaste. God damn, boss, I get my left nut for food that didn't look like a dildo, Amos said, then tapped his food against Naomi's in mock toast. Tell me about our water, Holden said. Well, I've been crawling around between hulls all day. I've tightened everything that can be tightened and slapped epoxy on anything that can't, so we aren't dripping anywhere. It'll still be right down to the wire, Jim, Naomi said.
The Knight's recycling systems are crap. She was never intended to process 5 people's worth of waste back into potables for 2 weeks. Down to the wire I can handle. We'll just learn to live with each other's stink. I was worried about nowhere near enough. Speaking of which, I'm going to head up to my rack and spray in some more deodorant, Amos said. After all day crawling in the ship's guts, my stink's even keeping me awake tonight. Amos swallowed the last of his food and smacked his lips with mock relish, then climbed out of his couch and headed down the crew ladder. Holden took a bite of his own bar. It tasted like greased cardboard. "What's Shed up to?" he asked. "He's been pretty quiet." Naomi, frowning, put her half-eaten bar down on the comm panel. "I wanted to talk to you about that. He's not doing well, Jim. Out of all of us, he's having the hardest time with what's happened. You and Alex were both Navy men. They train you to deal with losing shipmates. Amos has been flying so long, this is actually the 3rd ship that's gone down under him, if you can believe that." "And you are made entirely of cast iron and titanium," Holden said, only pretending to joke. "Not entirely. 80-90% tops," Naomi said with a half-smile. "Seriously, though, I think you should talk to him." "And say what? I'm no psychiatrist. The Navy version of this speech involves duty and honorable sacrifice and avenging fallen comrades. Doesn't work as well when your friends have been murdered for no apparent reason, and there's essentially no chance you can do anything about it." "I didn't say you had to fix him. I said you needed to talk to him." Holden got up from his couch with a salute. "Yes, sir," he said. At the ladder, he paused. "Again, thank you, Naomi. And really, I know. Go be the captain," she said, turning back to her panel and calling up the ship op screen. "I'll keep waving at the neighbors." Holden found Shed in the Knight's tiny sick bay, really more of a sick closet. Other than a reinforced cot, the cabinets of supplies, and a half-dozen pieces of wall-mounted equipment, there was just enough room for one stool stuck to the floor on magnetic feet. Shed was sitting on it. "Hey, buddy, mind if I come in?" Holden asked. Did I actually say, "Hey, buddy," he thought. Shed shrugged and pulled up an inventory screen on the wall panel, opening various drawers and staring at the contents, pretending he'd been in the middle of something. "Look, Shed, this thing with the Canterbury has really hit everyone hard, and you've..." Holden said. Shed turned, holding up a white squeeze tube. 3% acetic acid solution. Didn't realize we had this out here. The can's run out, and I've got 3 people with GW who could really use it. Why'd they put it on the Knight, I wonder?" Shed said. "GW? Was all Holden could think to reply. "Genital warts. Acetic acid solution is the treatment for any visible warts. Burns them off. Hurts like hell, but it does the job. No reason to keep it on the shuttle. Medical inventory is always so messed up." Holden opened his mouth to speak, found nothing to say, and closed it again. "We've got acetic acid cream," Shed said, his voice increasingly shrill, "but no Elemset for pain. Which do you think you'd need more on a rescue shuttle? If we'd found anyone on that wreck with a bad case of GW, we'd have been set. A broken bone, you're out of luck. Just suck it up." "Look, Shed," Holden said, trying to break in. "Oh, and look at this. No coagulant booster. What the hell? Hey, no chance anyone on a rescue mission could, you know, start bleeding. Catch a case of red bumps on your crank, sure, but bleeding? No way. I mean, we've got 4 cases of syphilis on the cant right now, one of the oldest diseases in the book, and we still can't get rid of it. I tell those guys, the hookers on Saturn Station are banging every ice bucker on the circuit, so put the glove on. But do they listen? No. So here we are with syphilis and not enough ciprofloxacin." Holden felt his jaw slide forward. He gripped the side of the hatch and leaned into the room. "Everyone on the cant is dead," Holden said, making each word clear and strong and brutal. "Everyone is dead. No one needs the antibiotics. No one needs wart cream." Shed stopped talking, and all the air went out of him like he'd been gut punched.
He closed the drawers in the supply cabinet and turned off the inventory screen with small, precise movements.
I know, he said in a quiet voice. I'm not stupid. I just need some time.
We all do. But we're stuck in this tiny can together. I'll be honest, I came down here because Naomi is worried about you. But now that I'm here, you're freaking me the hell out. It's okay because I'm the captain now and it's my job, but I can't have you freaking Alex or Amos out. We're 10 days from being grabbed by a Martian battleship, and that's scary enough without the doctor falling apart.
I'm not a doctor. I'm just a tech, Shed said, his voice very small.
You're our doctor, okay? To the four of us here, with you on this ship, you're our doctor. If Alex starts having post-traumatic stress episodes and needs meds to keep it together, he'll come to you. If you're down here jabbering about warts, he'll turn around and go back up to the cockpit and just do a really bad job of flying. You want to cry? Do it with all of us. We'll sit together in the galley and get drunk and cry like babies, but we'll do it together where it's safe. No more hiding down here.
Shed nodded.
Can we do that? He said.
Do what? Holden asked.
Get drunk and cry like babies?
Hell yes. That is officially on the schedule for tonight. Report to the galley at 2000 hours, Mr. Garvey. Bring a cup.
Shed started to reply when the general comm clicked on and Naomi said, Jim, come back up to ops. Holden gripped Shed's shoulder for a minute, then left. In ops, Naomi had the comm screen up again and was speaking to Alex in low tones. The pilot was shaking his head and frowning. A map glowed on her screen.
What's up? Holden asked.
We're getting a tight beam, Jim. It locked on and started transmitting just a couple minutes ago, Naomi replied.
From the Doniger?
The Martian battleship was the only thing he could think of that might be inside laser communications range.
No, from the belt, Naomi said. And not from Ceres or Eros or Pallas either. None of the big stations.
She pointed at a small dot on her display.
It's coming from here.
That's empty space, Holden said.
Nope, Alex checked. It's the site of a big construction project Tycho is working on. Not a lot of detail on it, but radar returns are pretty strong.
Something out there has a comm array that'll put a dot the size of Uranus on us from over 3 AU away, Alex said.
Okay, wow, that's impressive. What is our anus-sized dot saying? Holden asked.
You'll never believe this, Naomi said and turned on the playback. A dark-skinned man with the heavy facial bones of an Earther appeared on the screen. His hair was graying, and his neck was ropey with old muscle. He smiled and said,
Hello, James Holden. My name is Fred Johnson.
Holden hit the pause button.
This guy looks familiar.
Search the ship's database for that name, he said. Naomi didn't move. She just stared at him with a puzzled look on her face.
What? He said.
That's Frederick Johnson, she said.
Okay.
Colonel Frederick Lucius Johnson. The pause might have been a second. It might have been an hour.
Jesus, was all Holden could think to say.
The man on the screen had once been among the most decorated officers in the UN military, and ended up one of its most embarrassing failures. To Belters, he was the Earther Sheriff of Nottingham, who'd turned into Robin Hood. To Earth, he was the hero who'd fallen from grace. Fred Johnson started his rise to fame with a series of high-profile captures of Belt pirates during one of the periods of tension between Earth and Mars that seemed to ramp up every few decades and then fade away again. Whenever the system's two superpowers rattled their sabers at each other, crime in the Belt rose. Colonel Johnson, Captain Johnson at the time, and his small wing of 3 missile frigates destroyed 12 pirate ships and 2 major bases in a 2-year span.